Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. The following segment was recorded during a recent snowstorm from my home. It is widely known today that the newly elected Trump administration is executing a strategic assault against diversity, equity, and inclusion programs and initiatives across many industry sectors all over the nation. Trump has issued executive orders to end all DEI programs in the government and compel all government contractors, education institutions, and anyone who receives federal dollars to end their support for DEI efforts. Moreover, Trump has ordered the Department of Defense to end all acknowledgments of so-called identity months and holidays. The newly elected Republican administration is executing a well-planned long-term strategy of war waged against what it calls wokeism and multiculturalism in America. My guest today has a perspective on the societal conditions we're witnessing. His name is Keon West. He's a professor of social psychology at the University of London and president of the Society for the Psychological Study of Social Issues. He earned his doctorate at Oxford University as a Rhodes Scholar. He's published more than 70 quantitative papers on prejudice and discrimination in many peer-reviewed social psychology journals. He's been published by many national and international news media, and he's received numerous awards for his research, teaching, and social activism. And Professor West is author of a new book titled The Science of Racism, Everything You Need to Know, But Probably Don't Yet. Welcome to the exchange, Professor.
Oh, thank you, Mike. That was a very kind introduction.
So why did you write this book?
Oh, I wrote this book because I kept having the same conversation over and over again. There's lots of people out there with really strong beliefs about racism, really strong beliefs about whether or not it's happening and whether or not it's possible to measure it or to test for it in any way. Very strong beliefs about what to do about it, the best way of dealing with it. And I found that, unfortunately, a lot of these people were mistaken. And this was, you know, across the spectrum. These are people who I would say are really quite in favor of racism and people who are really quite opposed to it, both being really mistaken about what it is, what it looks like, how to measure it, and what to do about it if you'd like it to go down. And I thought that was a real shame because it doesn't take that much to explain to people what racism is or how it works. That this can be done in a fairly simple and straightforward way. But apparently, many people have just never come across the information. And because this information is widely known and incredibly well understood in social psychology, I just thought, why not write it down and see if it reaches people?
Well, you wrote in your introduction, and I'm going to quote, "This book is not about upending or reaffirming your cherished beliefs. Instead, it will lay out the facts about racism based rigorously and unerringly upon the best science we have at our disposal. There will be stories in it, some moving, some emotional, some eye-opening. But fundamentally, this book is about the scientific method, how we apply it to the study of racism, and what it reveals when we do," end quote. Professor West, this newly elected Trump administration is executing a political strategy that was decades in the making and aligned with the beliefs of hundreds of conservative organizations, institutions, and Christian church networks. So what makes you think that our society cares about science and facts when we operate on ill-informed beliefs?
I don't think that everyone cares about science and facts. I think the world is incredibly complex. And I think there's some portion of people who really don't care about what the facts say. I mean, I think Gallup polls reveal that a sizable proportion of Americans believe that the Earth is flat. And I think if the geologists can't win that fight, I don't think the psychologists are going to win it either. So I have no delusion about the fact that some people just aren't interested and just don't care. I do think a lot of people are interested. I think more people are interested than have had a chance to read the science. And I think many people believe themselves to be good people. They believe themselves to be well-intentioned. They believe themselves to not be racist or to want to be less racist or as non-racist as they can be. And I think those people, as long as they are honest enough to want to hear what the truth is, they will get something out of the book.
Your book is divided into four parts, with several chapters in each. So let's discuss each of the four parts, starting with part one, which you titled, "How Do We Know Racism is Real?" Can you address that question?
Yes, I think it's really important. I actually think that's the most important place to start, which is why I started with that section. I have spoken to fantastically intelligent people, and some of these people are not white. I was talking to another black Rhodes Scholar, much younger than myself, and she said to me, this is before the book came out, you can't possibly know that people are being racist. I mean, you can suspect, but you can't know. And I thought, how odd that someone so clever could not know something so simple. So, what do I mean when I say that we can know that racism exists? I would define racism as any detectable difference in treatment between two people or two groups of people that is dependent on race and nothing else. And that's a really straightforward definition. And by that, I mean, if you can control for everything else, if you can take care of all the other variables except race, and you still see a difference between the way people are being treated, some detectable difference, then you know that what's happening is racism. So how would you test for that? I'm using a lot of words like detectable and so on and so forth. How do you test for it? Very straightforwardly, in the book, I discuss CV experiments, which is an easy way to start. To do experiments like these, you just take my CV or your CV or anyone else's CV, it doesn't matter. And you make a few hundred or a few thousand copies of that CV, exactly the same. So you have a few thousand people, all of whom now have exactly the same qualifications and experience. And you change the name at the top of the CV to make it sound like these people are different from each other. So you could give half of the CVs white names and half of the CVs black names, and then you send them out into the world. And if people aren't being racist, if people are being not racist, because these CVs are exactly the same, because all these people are exactly as qualified and exactly as accomplished and exactly as experienced as each other, they should get exactly the same callback rates. They should get exactly the same job offers. They should be offered exactly the same money. And so that would be how we test for whether racism is happening. And what's happened every single time we do experiments like these is that, of course, they don't get the same callbacks or job offers or money. The white people, the quote unquote white people, because they're all the same person, but the quote unquote white people get offered more jobs, and they get offered them more quickly, and they get offered better jobs, and they get offered more money. And it's an incredibly reliable effect. And people have been doing experiments like these for decades, in many countries over and over again, not just white and black people, but white people, black people, Asian people, Latino people, all sorts of people. And from that, we not only know that racism is happening, we have numbers. We have numbers for how much racism is happening. Numbers like, I think, I mean, don't quote me on this, I think it's 36%, but do read the book. Sometimes I move it up and down a few percentage points. But we know that overall in the United States of America, there's about a 36% gap between white people and black people when they apply for jobs. And that is overall. There's some jobs where it's massive, where it's 100%, there's a huge gap, and some where it's much smaller. But on average, you get about 36% of an advantage just for being a white person. And that's how we know that racism is still happening.
My guest is Professor Keon West. He's a professor of social psychology at the University of London and president of the Society for the Psychological Study of Social Issues. He's also author of The Science of Racism: Everything You Need to Know But Probably Don't Yet. So, Professor, chapter one is titled, Do We Have a Problem? Disagreements About Contemporary Racism. What is contemporary racism?
Oh, well, contemporary racism is just racism that's happening today. And I think that's important. I think most people agree, even the very, very racist people, people who would identify themselves as racist, would agree that in the past, society was much more racist. People are aware that people were captured and enslaved. People are aware of segregation and of apartheid. I think the disagreement people have is whether racism is still happening now. And that's where people tend to argue with each other a bit more.
Well, let's go back to in the past for a moment. In 1860, Sidney George Fisher was a well-known attorney, slaveholding plantation owner, and the author of the book, a very popular book, called The Laws of Race as Connected with Slavery. And this is what he wrote. I'm going to quote. To understand slavery, therefore, we must study the nature of the white man and of the Negro. Out of the principles of their respective organizations, we may be sure slavery has grown and by them will be controlled. Those principles were impressed upon each by divine will, and the consequences that flow from them have the same source. Of these races, the white is the highest in scale, the black the lowest. The white alone possesses the intellectual and moral energy which creates that development of free government, industry, science, literature, and the arts, which we call civilization. The black can neither originate, maintain, nor comprehend civilization. He is by nature a barbarian. When in contact with the white race, he naturally and willingly yields to it and becomes its servant. The two races have exhibited these characteristics in all ages. The white race must, of necessity, by reason of its superiority, govern the Negro wherever the two live together. End quote. Professor, Sidney George Fisher's popular book, The Laws of Race, was based on social science. And it's what President Abraham Lincoln believed. Which is why Fisher endorsed him as a presidential candidate in 1860. It's also what the Young Republicans believed in 1860, and they called themselves the White Awakes. Fisher's social science, Professor, was woke ideology in the 19th century. And today, Republicans hate what they call wokeism. How do you reconcile this dichotomy?
Yes, I think people sometimes have a slightly magical view of science, which it doesn't want and doesn't require. I think if we went back to 1860 and were to examine our understanding of gravity, we could say that none of Einstein's theories at that time held any weight. Einstein, I wasn't born or wasn't practicing physics in 1860. And so everything we understand about relativity, about time dilation, about black holes, about all this stuff that we found out afterward, we could go back and say, well, this isn't true. You could go back a few years and say, well, in the past, scientists thought Pluto was a planet, now they don't. And a very small number of people, I do know some people who get very upset about the Pluto thing, but it's a very small number of people who would say, well, in 1860, the understanding of physics said this, and now it says that. How can we reconcile it? I think most people just understand that science progresses as we get better information and as the biases that we've built into the system get weeded out. Science is a self-correcting process, not a perfect one, and the people doing it are clearly biased. They are biased towards geocentric views of the world. They're biased towards white views of the world and ethnocentric views of the world. But over time, as we learn better things about gravity, better things about geology, better things about evolution, better things about societies and social psychology, a lot of the ideas that would have been popular 100, 200, 300 years ago don't work because the evidence doesn't support them. And in much the same way that we have a much better model of the universe now than we did in 1860, we have a much better understanding of social psychology now.
But Professor, what Sidney George Fisher described was called racial hierarchy, that valuing and devaluing humans by this mythological construct of race and white supremacy. That is precisely what people still believe in today.
A lot of people do believe that. I would say a much larger number of people, if you ask them, would not admit, although to be honest, politics changes quite, they all change quite quickly. So maybe if we were to do it again exactly today, the numbers would be a bit different. But in recent history, most people do not admit to being open white supremacists who just think white people are better and great and smarter and meant to dominate other people. Most people wouldn't admit to that. And actually, a large proportion of people get incredibly offended if you suggest that they have those beliefs. Now, whether or not they still harbor the beliefs on some level, that's a different question. But most people wouldn't. Some people do. And even those people who do harbor those beliefs also harbor other related beliefs about society. So, for example, they believe that the reason why white people are less likely to be unemployed than black people in the United States of America, which they are, so that's a real difference. They believe that that difference is attributable to white people's inherent superiority and black people's inferiority. And whether this is biological or cultural or whatever else, they believe that if black people just did what white people did, they would get the same jobs, that if they could just get the same grades in school and the same behavioral record and the same everything else, and then they were to apply, they'd be treated as well. And I think even
Professor, hold that thought. hold that thought, because I need to take a quick break and I want to come back with that particular thought on the other side. My guest is Professor Keon West, author of a new book, The Science of Racism, Everything You Need to Know But Probably Don't Yet. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on JPR. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Keon West. He's a professor of social psychology at the University of London and president of the Society for the Psychological Study of Social Issues. Professor West is author of a new book, The Science of Racism, Everything You Need to Know But Probably Don't Yet. Professor, before we went to the break, I unfortunately had to cut you off, but I'd like for you to resume your thought.
Yes, so I was saying that even those people who are just really racist, who genuinely believe in the superiority of white people, they use that belief to explain the differences that exist in society. So in American society and in British society, that's where I live, black people are more likely, proportionally more likely to be unemployed than white people. And the really racist people believe, for various reasons, that if black people could just do the things white people did, if they could get the same grades, perform as well in various areas in school, not get into trouble with the law, that kind of thing, and then they were to apply to jobs at the same qualifications, they'd get the same treatment. But all the experiments show that that's not true. And that can be surprising even for the people who are just dyed-in-the-wool racists who think, this is all the black people's fault. They're doing bad stuff. If they could just do what we did, they'd be treated just as well. When they see the outcomes of these experiments, when they see that actually we've done exactly that so many times, hundreds of times, and we send out these CVs with exactly the same stuff, one by a black person, one by a white person, they don't. They never get the same treatment. That shows that something else is going on. It shows even those people that if black people were to be every bit as good as white people in society, they would still not be treated as well. And we know that.
So, Professor, what's interesting is that you deal in facts. So
yes.
I'm going to give you a fact.
Okay.
That has not changed since the Civil War. And that is that poor, vulnerable black children in this country after the Civil War were ubiquitously served by the worst quality public schools this nation had to offer. Now, here we are, eight generations later, and I can still say with 100% certainty that poor black children in America are ubiquitously served by the worst quality schools in the world's richest nation. That stat has not changed, and we don't even talk about it in our politics, in our churches, or even in our schools. Why?
Yes. So I think that brings up a different kind of racism. And I have to admit, it's a racism that the book, my book, doesn't address as much as the other kind. So let's talk about the two kinds. The kind of racism that I was talking about with the last experiment, I'd call that individual racism, which means someone has to be racist to make the racist stuff happen. So someone on the other side has to be looking at these CVs, looking at the white one, looking at the black one, and for whatever reason, deciding that the white one is better. And maybe they do this consciously, unconsciously. Maybe they do it because they actually perceive the white one as better. Maybe they realize that it's not better. They just like white people. There are loads of explanations, and the book does get into all the possible reasons, but that's still some person choosing to do something racistly, to put it that way. The other problem you have, though, is a structural problem, a systemic problem, a problem by which someone sets up rules so that even if no individual person chooses to do racist things, and that never happens, that's not how the world works. But let's imagine that nobody was doing racist things. Even then, you get really aggressively racist outcomes by setting up the rules in a particular way. And when you come to the American school-based system, there is a federal government in the United States of America. There's definitely a way of creating, building, funding, supplying schools that is entirely divorced from property taxes. It's not a necessity that schools are run on property taxes. They actually aren't in many other countries in the world. But America has chosen a system by which schools are intrinsically tied to property and to the wealth of the people who live around. And America also has done a number of other interesting systemic things like redlining to make sure that there'd be less investment in ethnic minority neighborhoods and other things that mean that their neighborhoods are poorer and therefore their schools are poorer. And with the combination of these rules, things like redlining and by tying schools to property taxes, you essentially guarantee that ethnic minority children will be in poorer and worse school districts. You make that happen, and that will continue to happen until the rules are changed. Even if the people in the system don't necessarily want racist things to happen, that will continue to happen until someone does something about the rules.
Professor, in your book, you do address systemic racism.
Yes, not enough, though, not nearly enough. I do most of my research on the individual type. So I talk about the systemic, but I have to admit, I think other people talk about it more. And sometimes I think maybe I should have spoken about it more, but you can only write a book that's so long.
In part two of your book, you address conscious and unconscious bias. The first chapter is titled, "They Know Not What They Do." Yes. What do you mean?
It's a reference to many things, to the Bible, it's a reference to a song lyric, it's a reference to a lot of things. I wrote that chapter in particular because people talk so much about unconscious bias, or at least they used to. Suddenly they might stop because of the change in the political climate. But up until very recently, unconscious bias was it. Everyone was talking about how much unconscious bias was important, that most bias, or even all bias in some cases, is unconscious, that when we're doing things, we don't realize we're being biased. We do it unconsciously. And I have to admit, I got kind of sick of that because it's not true. And I have to be a bit nuanced about this. There are such things as implicit biases, and those are biases which people have. So these, when people do biased things, it's always starting from the starting point of people are doing biased stuff, but they are either unwilling or unable to communicate how much they do this bias stuff. So the implicit bias measures can get at that, even if people are unwilling or unable to communicate about it. But the jump to saying that all bias or most bias was unconscious is totally unwarranted and unscientific. A staggering amount of bias is very conscious, and we need to be aware of that.
Well, chapter six is titled Deception, Doing Racist Things and Lying About It.
Yes. I didn't really pull punches with that chapter because I thought it was important that some experiments do show that people do racist stuff and then lie. They are perfectly aware of the fact that what they're doing is racist, and then they lie. There's one particularly great experiment, which I do describe in some detail, which is essentially the CV experiment again. So you send out the CVs to apply for jobs, except instead of CVs, you send real people as well. People who look similarly and who act very much the same way and who say the same things and have the same qualifications, but one's black, one's white, one's Latino, and they go out to apply for these jobs. And what they encounter is a shocking amount of just lying, of people who are openly racist but lying so that they can't be detected by the applicants themselves. There was even a story of one woman who called the white and the Latino candidate back and said, "Oh, you just need to sign something. Come back, and sent the black one away. And as soon as the white and the Latino candidate were there, she just openly explained the lie and said, I just didn't want the black guy here. Can you start work today?" Which shows that at least some of the time, people are perfectly aware of the fact that they're doing racist things, and they just lie and they cover it up.
My guest is Professor Keon West. He's a professor of social psychology at the University of London and president of the Society for the Psychological Study of Social Issues. He's also author of The Science of Racism, Everything You Need to Know But Probably Don't Yet. Professor, in part three of your book, you address what you call the complexities of racism. Chapter eight is titled The Other Side of the Game, Reverse Racism. Really? Please explain.
Yes. So many people are quite concerned about reverse racism, the idea that ethnic minorities can use their power over white people, can hate white people, can essentially do the racism, but do it against white people. And while I can understand, especially if you are a white person, which I'm not, so understandably this would concern me slightly less, but if you are a white person, I could see why you could perceive that as a realistic problem, as a real threat. You could see things like affirmative action policies as being a form of reverse racism, giving unfair advantages to ethnic minorities and disadvantaging white people. And while this is a widespread concern, at least for some people, it's not a concern that's grounded in any of the science or evidence that we have. There are some basic facts about the way things work that make this concern a bit silly, to be just a bit silly, which is that, for example, we know, like I said, when white people apply for jobs against equally qualified black people, they get better offers. But that's everything, right? It's not just jobs. when you apply to go to schools, you get more supports, you get better feedback, you get better callbacks than Black students applying to go to the same schools. When you go to doctors, when you interact with the police, when you do essentially anything, you get these advantages. And the affirmative action policies, I'm using those because they're an example that people say about reverse racism, these aren't benefiting ethnic minorities over white people. These are intended to address the imbalance that we already know exists, that scientifically we can prove exists. And they don't even do that. They don't even fully address these imbalances. So the idea that this is a form of reverse racism really has to depend on a deep, and I say the word not in an offensive way, just literally a not knowing, just being ignorant of, but it requires a deep ignorance of the way things work and a concern about something that just isn't happening.
It's interesting because after the Civil War, when the radical Republicans in Congress created the Freedmen's Bureau, the argument against the Freedmen's Bureau through President Andrew Johnson and others like him was that it gave advantage to Black people at the expense of white people, although they created a white nation at the expense of everyone else. So it was really remarkable that they would make that argument. I want to move to the subheader that you had in your book called Power, Privilege, and Context. And you offer a hypothetical circumstance of two white German men making anti-Semitic statements several generations apart.
Yes. When I try to explain, I have tried many times. And so the book has come out of my attempts to explain some of these things to people, some of whom are white people, some of whom are my white friends. And some of them have a really hard time understanding why power or context makes a difference. So if they say, I hate Black people, and if I say, I hate white people, which I don't, by the way, I really like white people. Some of my best friends are white people. But if I say, I hate white people, this should be treated the same as if they say they hate Black people. And it's a way of explaining why that's not the case in white Western societies like the United States of America or the UK. And so the example is two German men, really aggressively anti-Semitic, like super hyper-racist German men, both saying that they hate Jewish people and they want to do bad things to them. But one of them says it to a Jewish man on the streets of Berlin in late 1938 or 1939 or early 1939, something like that. And the other one says it in Israel in early 2024, something like that. And the difference isn't in the men. It's not in the German men. Each of the German men, they're the same. They're equally hateful, equally anti-Semitic. But the difference is in the structure of the society. In 1938, 1939, Germany, the German man saying that has the power of an aggressively anti-Semitic state behind him, one that will not defend the Jewish person's rights, one that will not listen to the Jewish person if he complains, oh, I'm being harassed or I'm being put in danger, one that will probably just lock the Jewish person up and send him away to die. All of these things are serious problems. If the German man were to try the same thing in 2024 Israel, he'd have a really different situation on his hands. He would be slapped down with the full power of the Israeli state. And that difference means something. That difference means that even though both men's hearts are equally evil, you know, if we're going to say that, the power they have to enact this evil is drastically different. And that has to be taken into account. And that's also true when we say, you know, how does reverse racism not work? Why don't people consider this a real thing in scientific circles? It's because of the power that ethnic minorities have to enact such hatred on white people. Essentially, we don't. And white people have a lot more to enact it the other way. And that's why it makes a difference.
Oh, my word. We only have a minute left. And I have so many questions. You talk about dealing with racism scientifically. You address the colorblind approach, but we can't get into that because we have 1 minute. I'm going to ask you this last question, though. You have a chapter titled, "A Change is Gonna Come, Remembering Systemic Racism." A change is gonna come, remembering systemic racism. What change do you hope for?
The change I hope for is that we start addressing racism in a way that requires us to care less about what white people think. And to sum that up really quickly, it's just that almost all the approaches to dealing with racism that I encounter, and not in the scientific realm, but in public, have to deal with convincing white people to like ethnic minorities more. And while that's great, thumbs up to that, I have no problem with it. I think we need changes of power, of structure, of system, things that allow ethnic minorities to just stop caring whether white people like them or not. I think when you've done that, that's when you've really done something about racism.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. Thank you, Professor, for such an enlightening and empowering book.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that.
My guest was Keon West. He's a professor of social psychology at the University of London and president of the Society for the Psychological Study of Social Issues. Professor West is also the author of a new book, The Science of Racism, Everything You Need to Know But Probably Don't Yet. And that's it for today's JX. JeffExchange.org is our website where you can find these conversations and more. Or subscribe to our shows wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Mike Green.